All right, you guys can start when you're ready.
Okay, and so you'll start the clock with me. Okay, so John, I'm going to pause for a minute, and then I'm going to say good morning and do an introduction to you. And when I say good morning again, you'll say hi or something, okay?
Sure.
All right.
Ready?
Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. This is the second in our series of discussions about California and Californians who talk about themselves, their lives, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning, our guest is John Borsos, a leader of the new union based here in the Bay Area, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, NUHW. Borsos is the elected secretary treasurer of NUHW. He's a founder of the union and is best known as an organizer and a tough negotiator. He lives with his family in Sacramento. John was born in Ohio, in an industrial town south of Cleveland, Barberton, Ohio. He was educated there in Ohio and at the Indiana University, where he received a PhD in history. John came to California in 1996 for the Service Employees International Union Local 250. So let's get right to it. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Cal. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Great to have you on the program. John, let me begin with a very simple, straightforward question about you and your work. Why labor? Why work for labor? What's that all about? And why today? The unions remain as in decline. They represent fewer than 10% of the workforce. There have been some interesting reversals lately, the Madison Uprising, the longshoremen's fight in Washington State, the teachers' strike in Chicago, but even these were defensive struggles with mixed outcomes. So what's with you? Why are you working for labor, and why is that important to you?
Well, you know, I grew up in a working-class family in Ohio where the labor movement was really a fundamental part of what people did. I mean, it was, as you said, south of Cleveland in the Akron area where most people belonged to a union. The union was a way that, people were able to deliver a meaningful life for their families, a decent wage, respect at the workplace, some determination for their future. And I think a lot of that was internalized. And I guess as many became aware later in life politically, I think I realized, as many others have, that the labor movement remains a very viable way to unite people, around social justice issues. It's the broadest, most collective mechanism for uniting people around a progressive agenda. And as especially as corporate America continues and corporate capitalism in general becomes stronger and stronger, the need for people to be united and acting in the collective way becomes more important. And the labor movement today is in its weakest state since at least the 1920s, and the importance of being involved and keeping the movement going and hopefully inspiring some kind of a resurgence is a distinct critical work for people to do.
And you say social justice and a progressive agenda. How do you connect that to the nuts and bolts of trade unionism?
Well, even going back to the early days of the CIO and before that,
You better explain what the CIO is, sorry, and maybe say a word about it.
Back in the 1930s or even at the turn of the last century, there was a drive to create industrial unions to make the labor movement much more representative of workers generally rather than a handful of skilled craftspeople, traditionally white males, who were the foundation of the labor movement up to that point. And the idea behind the CIO, which was, arguably one of the most progressive, broad-based, intellectual and social movement forces in the United States, was bringing democracy, the democracy into the workplace. The idea that workers should have some voice in how work was carried out, what their wages and working conditions should be, so that the principles of, you know, American society, American jurisprudence, that, you know, people have a right to vote, this inherent American concept, that kind of idea is brought into the workplace, that people not only have rights outside of the workplace, but they have those in when they're at work. And you consider how much time people spend at work, the idea that you have some say, some ability to determine in your own way, collectively, some way of your working conditions. It's a critical thing, I think, for people to aspire to. And, you know, so I guess it's within that framework.
And you've told me in the past, haven't you, that you've always felt personally connected to the Congress of, Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO. You've told me that you've felt a personal connection through your family and your Ohio community.
Well, yeah, where I grew up, you know, was in, like I said, Akron area, the Cleveland area. And it's funny, I didn't realize it at the time, but more so when I was in graduate school, that a number of the big strikes that really laid the foundation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, there's a massive strike at Goodyear, which is the big rubber manufacturing plant in Akron, in 1936. I actually have an uncle who was a sit-down striker at General Motors in 1937. You know, there were a lot of personal connections that I had. And actually, one of the interesting things is that I think that the labor movement really hasn't done a particularly good job of passing along history, because a number of these things, even my own personal connections around this, were buried. And it was only when I began to pursue studies in labor history that I found these things out, as opposed to being part of everyday consciousness. So there's a lot of struggles and a lot of just incredible victories that workers have won that haven't made it into the history books. And I think forces people, or requires people, therefore, to sometimes reinvent the wheel much more often than is necessary. And so it's the ability to learn from and be inspired by people in the past who have won incredible victories against pretty formidable odds. It's something I think that is too often lost.
And how did you get interested in history and become a historian as well? As I think I said, you went to Indiana University and did a PhD there. What tell us a bit about that.
Well, I had always liked history, and I actually, when I started graduate school, didn't understand that there was a sector of labor history, and took a class on the 1930s actually my first semester in graduate school, and was assigned, I did a report on the biography of John L. Lewis, who was the leader of the United Mine Workers, who was the founder of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And in the John L. Lewis biography, it talked about these strikes that were happening in Goodyear in Akron that I had not been aware of. And then, I talked to my dad about it, and talked to, others who, some of whom had participated in that strike, and then ultimately learned some of the stuff from my uncle that, had a natural interest in history. And then when I found out that there was this whole body of labor history that was out there that I hadn't known in the past, it's just something I gravitated towards. And then I realized that there really hadn't been that much work done on the labor movement and in the the Akron Cleveland area. So I then focused on that, and that's what I wrote my dissertation on.
And there's been some discussion, I don't know how far it's gone, in comparing the our Great Recession to the Great Depression of the 1930s, except that we don't have a CIO. Did the CIO play an important part, do you think, in pushing the reforms of that era?
I think there were a number of things that were going on. Even before the CIO was formed, there was a great deal of upsurge that happened in a number of factories across the U.S. in the earliest days of the Depression. 1929 to 1932, there were a lot of spontaneous strikes that grew up in a number of places. And then especially after, 1932, when Roosevelt was elected, and one of the first acts that was passed as part of the New Deal was the National Industrial Recovery Act, the NIRA, and there was a provision in there that ostensibly gave labor the right to organize, Section 7A, and a lot of people saw that it was an endorsement of the federal government towards unionization, even though in reality the legislation itself did very little to do that. But it created this, I would say, a sense of hope and aspiration among a group of workers. And then what you really saw was this just massive upsurge of strike activity during that time period, including, general strikes in San Francisco and Toledo and Minneapolis. And the ability for workers to come together and make those kinds of changes forced the federal government to act. That's when you saw the first real piece of legislation that gave workers the right to organize, which was the Wagner Act. It was like a follow up to this Section 7A of the National Industrial Recovery Act. So there was a worker component to the New Deal, but you also saw society move to the left, and a lot of this came, out of the labor movement. There was an active Communist Party and, Socialist Party in the 1930s that pushed legislation to the left. I think the Roosevelt administration was more responsive to what was going on in the streets than other administrations. And I think another thing that was going on was you had a real, crisis in the leadership of capitalism. It's like one of the few moments in history where there was a great deal of uncertainty on the part of, what I would describe as the corporate elites, the ruling class, whatever, nomenclature, one wants to use. And I think that hesitancy is what created space for an enormous amount of experimentation and regulation and the understanding that those who were in charge of corporations really didn't have a grasp of what was going on. And you kind of see that today, especially with the profound lack of confidence that people have in the banking industry. Although the response is not, a more significant government intervention, the response is a mild government intervention, almost to the point of, probably more so than it has been since the 30s, but not in any kind of way that is, I think, meaningful or meaningful enough to produce these, decade-long changes like we saw in the 30s. So kind of a long-winded answer, but that's how I connect them.
Well, important background. So when you were completed your studies, it probably wasn't much of a surprise that you would look to work in the labor movement itself. Is that right? Or
I became, active more as a graduate student at Indiana. The graduate students were starting to organize, and then upon graduation, I taught a little bit, and then began looking for possibilities in the labor movement. And at this was in the early 90s, and there were very few unions who were hiring in that way. Most unions at the time, you had to come up through the ranks, and that's where they hired staff. And among the few who were hiring were SEIU, the Service Employees International, the United Electrical Workers. Those for the most part were the unions who were hiring people, like me, either as college students or graduate students, or where they were people who were not coming from within that union.
So you went to SEIU and came out to Sacramento, is that?
Well, I started working for SEIU in Pennsylvania, the Healthcare Workers Union in Pennsylvania, and worked there for about 3 years, and then got to know the people in Local 250 in California. Sal Roselli had been elected on a slate in the late 1980s, 1988, where the international union had placed the local in trusteeship in 1987, 1988, and there were a group of progressive trade unionists within the local who were able to win the election in a very controversial vote in 1988, and then began to build a progressive really rank and file oriented movement out here in California, and a very progressive healthcare workers union. And so got to know Sal and others through through meetings in SEIU, and some point in the late 1995 talked to him about coming out, and then joined Local 250 in 1996.
And Sal Roselli, he's the president now, isn't he, of NUHW, the National Union of Healthcare Workers?
Oh, yeah. Sal and a woman named Shirley Ware were elected as the secretary-treasurer of... Sal was elected as the president of Local 250 in 1988, and Shirley was the secretary-treasurer at the same time, and built Local 250 into, ultimately a 150,000 member, statewide union within SEIU, and that was in, through the 90s and into 2009, and then the union was taken over again another trusteeship by SEIU in 2009, and then we created the National Union of Healthcare Workers in response to that in January of 2009.
Well, maybe we'll come back to that in a minute, but maybe could you tell us a little bit about union work, about what your jobs have been, and with healthcare workers, I guess I should ask, what's the nitty gritty of the day in and day out work that you do or have done as well?
Yeah, well, there's like two or three, I guess, basic kind of work that a union organizer does. And, one is to help workers who are unorganized come together to join a union. And in the United States, really since the time that I've been working in the labor movement, which is, 20-something years, the intense struggle that workers have to go through to win a union, unless somebody has gone through it, it's not something that a lot of people would comprehend. It's really a form of industrial warfare where, there are very high-priced consultants who are brought in to a work site to actively discourage workers from organizing a union. People are allowed to be pulled off of work, to be subjected to what we describe as captive audience meetings, where the managers will show movies and talk to people for hours at a time. And in healthcare in particular, these are patient caregivers who are taken away from the bedside to hear anti-union an anti-union message about you know, why workers should not vote to be represented. So it's helping workers go through that process. You know, again, in the United States, it's perfectly legal for a worker to be pulled in the office of her manager with another manager to be told why the employer does not think it would be in that worker's interest to vote for a union. Having these one-on-one meetings or two-on-one meetings or captive audience meetings are all perfectly legal. And so one aspect of union work is helping workers go through that fight to be recognized as a union. And it can be a fairly long, drawn-out process. You have to get 30% of the workers minimally in a work site to sign a petition to be represented. You file that petition with the National Labor Relations Board if it's a private sector employer. The employers then tend to delay the election as long as possible by using, you know, legal maneuvers to delay the scheduling of an election. The purpose behind the delay is to allow an employer to really campaign and discourage people from voting for a union. So, I mean, and part of the work of an organizer is, you know, dealing with, you know, those legal, you know, the hearings and things like that. But more importantly, again, keeping people together as you go through that election. So then, you know, there's been a campaign and then an election. And if the election is then successful, then you have to negotiate a contract. So one phase of union work is the helping workers organize a union, and then the second, you know, part is, you know, negotiating a contract. A majority of workers, after they win a union election, are not successful in winning a contract. So once the employers, you know, have you know, put themselves in a position to, you know, fight workers when they're organizing a union, that doesn't end when the election ends. They then many employers will do everything they can to prevent workers from getting a contract. They'll stall out bargaining for as long as possible, you know, with an effort to try to force another election. You have to wait a year between elections before you can force workers to vote again whether they want to be represented or not. So, but the second part of union work then is focused on helping to negotiate a contract, and that includes, you know, recruiting a bargaining committee and, you know, helping people come together and put together contract language, and then, you know, determining what are the most important issues to go into a contract, and then electing a bargaining team, and then meeting with the bargaining team with the employer. And a lot of what I've done is the actual, you know, negotiations with an employer, where you and a group of employees sit down with a group of management, and then hammer out an agreement. Then, you know, that process can take anywhere from, you know, months and months to, in some cases, a year and a half, 2 years to negotiate a contract. And so, you know, the work of an organizer is maintaining a unity among the workforce and keeping people educated about what's going on in the bargaining process and you know, making sure that people's interests are represented, and then having to deal with employers and the committee and things like that. And then I guess a third part of union work would be, especially in healthcare, is involved in politics, because so much of the financing and the regulation of healthcare is, you know, under the purview of the government, that it's critical that workers are involved in the political process and they're engaged in that. And so sometimes it can be dealing with you know, the actual governmental agencies, you know, the health inspection, you know, you know, through the state as they, you know, are around regulation that way. And then other things can be working on actual legislation and then, you know, the political process. So I guess in a nutshell, the three components of union work are organizing workers, and then negotiating contracts, and then the political work.
Let me take a break John, this is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today for Talking About California. Our guest is John Borsos. John is the Secretary Treasurer of the National Union of Healthcare Workers. And we're talking about the labor movement and the healthcare industry. I should also say at this point that listeners need to remember that tonight the pledge drive here at KZYX begins. The pledge drive begins tonight, and we encourage everyone to pledge and be generous. John, shifting a bit here then, tell us a bit about the industry you work in, about the healthcare industry. I mean, we all know about it, but maybe you could give us a sort of a the bigger picture of an industry, in, say, here in California, for starts.
Oh, sure. You know, I think a lot of people's conception of the healthcare industry is you know, what you may have thought it was in the past, as in contrast to what it really is now. And I saw a statistic several years ago. I don't know how accurate it is now, that most people are in the hospital like once every 16 years, and there's a tremendous amount that has changed in the last 15 or 20 years in healthcare. And California really has been on the cutting edge of a number of these changes. It wasn't so long ago that most healthcare was delivered in a community-based single standalone hospital, whether it was a memorial hospital or a religious-based institution or a public hospital that was community-based. You had a board of directors who were rooted in that community. It was really a community-rooted institution. Healthcare today is incredibly corporatized. And it's really a product of the last 15 or 20 years, where with the emergence of managed care, a number of hospitals began to consolidate, and in California in particular, you have what used to be, again, these small standalone community-based institutions that are really a relic of the past now. Most hospitals are part of a large corporation, and in some cases those corporations are for-profit, and in other cases they are not-for-profit. The most significant difference between a for-profit and a not-for-profit, as cynical as it may sound, is that a not-for-profit doesn't pay taxes on its earnings, and a for-profit does. But there used to be differences, again, going back to this community-based origin of a number of not-for-profit systems. But now the way that these multi, 15, 20, 30, in some cases 40 hospital systems operate, there really is not much of a distinguishing difference between a for-profit company and a not-for-profit company. So the community-based flavor that, or the responsiveness that one may have experienced in the past about a hospital, it's now more of a corporate entity. Another critical thing about healthcare is that so much of the cost of healthcare is in labor cost, and because the work that is performed in healthcare is taking care of people, and that is it's a hands-on kind of industry. So, for example, in a manufacturing plant, about 25% of the cost or so are in labor costs, and the rest are in materials. If you're talking about an automobile plant, the steel to manufacture the cars and the upholstery and whatnot to make the seats and the glass for to put in the windows. The other 75% are non-labor costs. In healthcare, the costs are between 50 to 60% of the employer's costs go into the staff. So there is an incredible pressure on employers, as a way of as a measure to maximize profit, to try to get you know, fewer people to do more work because so much of their profit is based on labor cost, which makes it makes issues around staffing the critical issues in healthcare. So I guess in summary, you know, what you see in the healthcare industry is it's a growing industry, and you know, as we all know, it's something that has become much more profitable, and it's an institution or it's an industry that has become much more corporate-based over the last 15 or 20 years.
Now, you've just talked about hospitals, but I think I also recall once that you told me it was your opinion that nursing homes, and I think they're part of the purview of your union and the labor movement, nursing homes were the equivalent in the 21st century of sweatshops of the past. Do you still hold that position?
You're right. The hospitals are one sector of the healthcare industry. You know, another major sector is the nursing home industry or the long-term care industry. And the same kind of pressures in hospitals are also found, in fact, in some cases more prevalent in nursing homes. Again, nursing homes generally are part of corporate entities. The profitability in nursing homes are even sometimes more contested because of the underfunding of both Medicare for nursing home care and Medicaid for nursing home care. So the cost for an employer sometimes can be capped on the amount of money allocated per patient day. So a nursing home operator receives compensation for your loved one in the nursing home on a per day basis, on a per diem basis, and there is an enormous incentive to maximize profit by driving down. Again, you go back to this model of labor costs. The staff at the bedside is the single biggest cost factor for an employer, and that's also true in a nursing home. So their costs are fixed. The reimbursement is fixed, and they're having to try to maximize profit. And the only thing that they can do to really change that is try to squeeze more work out of folks. And that's why the pressure in nursing homes is even more enormous than it is in hospitals. And the corporatization of the nursing home industry, you know, that goes back into the 60s and before. So you have a much more developed business model. And this is also a place where you know, there's been a significant movement of the Bain Capitals of the world, those kind of corporate investors, you know, that really just see the work of a nursing home as a way to maximize profit, and again, it's just the squeeze. So you have these investors coming in as a way to just drive the cost out, and again, that produces that squeeze in the workplace itself, because so much of the work is being done by caregivers at the bedside, and that's where the profit margin comes in.
So back to hospital workers and nurses, I think the idea persists that these are pretty well-paid people and that they work for pretty benign employers. Kaiser Permanente, the giant HMO, for example, was set up for Kaiser workers, and its emphasis seems to be on preventing illness, on keeping people well. What's the problem there? And secondly, it doesn't, you know, nurses seem to make a lot of money, and other hospital workers as well. What's the problem there?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Oh, I'm sticking with the bigger question in the background is, why are we talking about unions, unionization for hospital workers and nurses? If they have good jobs, the pay is good, and their employers are benign.
Well, very few employers that I've encountered are benign. So that may be the myth of the healthcare provider. A lot of people go into healthcare, you know, probably more so than most industries, because they really feel this need to take care of folks. I think people who gravitate towards the healthcare industry, there's a sense of compassion and the belief that they're in a profession that helps them, that they're helping others, and that's a consistent, you know, cultural dimension to being a healthcare worker. And I think for a long time, a lot of employers took advantage of that kind of self-sacrifice mentality to assume that meant that workers were going to be willing to, you know, give up certain things, you know, for the overall good. And I think that was, you know, true before the advent of labor union organizing in healthcare, you know, back in the 1930s. In fact, you know, Local 250 was actually the first healthcare workers union formed in the country. This is SEIU Local 250 that you know I was talking about earlier, and that union formed out of the San Francisco General Strike in 1934, and really since then, the motivation for workers to create a union in healthcare was, while there were some employers that were more responsible and I guess more progressive in their attitude towards wages and working conditions for their employees, others were not. And really the Bay Area became the launching pad for healthcare workers union organizing. And the decent wages and benefits that are associated with healthcare in California really are a product of that organization that happened in the Bay Area in the 1930s and 40s. Outside of the Bay Area, healthcare work was really not seen as a lucrative career for folks to go into. I think then. The motivation for the Bay Area was to try to achieve wages that are commensurate with what was being won in the Bay Area, and that included then, you know, decent wages, affordable health care. You know, one of the byproducts of health care companies, you know, was and continues to be in the non-union sector, is that health care providers themselves are having to pay hundreds of dollars per month for health insurance. But another significant motivation why healthcare workers organize is really it's about voice on the job. When you're a provider, a healthcare provider, a caregiver, it's critical that, you know, you make life and death decisions every day regarding a patient, and you want to be able to have some kind of say to make sure that care is delivered in an appropriate way, in a way that, you know, doesn't threaten your licensure, that, you know, makes it a safer experience for patients. And a lot of the motivation for people today about why they organize a union often is less about wages and benefits, although that certainly motivates some. But it's more about say at the workplace. How is care delivered? What is the best way to deliver that care? How is staffing? You know, can we have a say in staffing? You know, the kind of decision making about you know, how work is performed. In some cases, as much if not more so than wages and working conditions.
I guess I was also just trying to think, it seems the healthcare industry tries to present itself to the public as this deeply caring complex of institutions and so forth. And yet, when it comes down to the kind of issues you've just been discussing, you know, people's rights at work as well as their living standards and so forth, they can be tenacious opponents. Just closer to home here, I think you know about the situation at St. Joseph's Memorial in Santa Rosa, where the company, what was it, fought for 9 years to keep the union out?
Yeah, correct. Right. Nine years.
And how could they do that? I mean,
well, there was, you know, use every mechanism that you have at your disposal to delay. At a place like it's Santa Rosa Memorial, which is part of the St. Joseph's Health System, you know, workers, you know, their quest to have a union, the first attempt went back, I think it was even 20, 25 years ago. And then with us, when we were in the Service Employees International Union, the nine-year struggle you're talking about, when workers started saying, you know, coming together and saying that they wanted to create a union, you know, there were just the opposition to that from the company in hiring union busters, hiring union consultants, you know, the captive audience meetings and the one-on-ones that I talked about, using the slightest you know, legal maneuvers to effectuate delays as long as possible. Even in that situation where we won, you know, we won the election in December of 2009, after we won the election, there was another year delay before the unit was certified, before we could even get to the bargaining table because of another legal maneuver. And then when we got to the bargaining table, it took another year and 3 months to negotiate a contract. You know, ironically, you know, since then, things have the relations between, you know, the workers and the hospital have improved, you know, pretty significantly. But it's an indication of the, you know, anti-union mentality of most employers generally, but hospital employers, you know, specifically. Even though there's this, as you said, this benign impression sometimes that's left that, you know, these hospital systems are you know, really these responsible community institutions. You know, the reality is that you know, they operate like some of the most ruthless corporations that exist in the U.S.
Well, here on the coast, on the Mendocino coast, the management at our local district hospital in Fort Bragg has recently filed for bankruptcy, and it's said widely that its purpose in doing this is to break its contract with its employees. Now, I don't know if you know anything about the specifics of this hospital, but is that something that happens more than once, and why would they choose to do that? And maybe you could say something about problems in the more public sector of the hospital industry.
Well, you know, we represent a number of public district hospitals, like, you know, the hospital in Mendocino is. That's a pretty extreme step that a hospital would attempt to declare bankruptcy for the purposes of avoiding a union contract. I mean, there's a way to declare bankruptcy that you can get outside of the contract, you know, provision set aside, but the union doesn't go away, and so it's kind of a short-sighted and I'm not as familiar with it, you know, because it's not a place that we represent. So you know, some of this is a little bit conjectural, but I mean, if that's the effort, it's a pretty ill-advised measure for the management to take, because the union doesn't go away, and you know, you have to figure out a way to work through, you know, the financial issues of the institution, which, you know, the public sector, including public district hospitals like that facility, you know, for a while, you know, several decades ago, those facilities were, you know, pretty well situated in an environment of, you know, single standalone community-based institutions. institutions because, you know, there was also inability to raise, you know, funds through the hospital district as necessary. Now, those hospitals are often competing with, you know, larger, you know, better resourced corporations that you know, make it more difficult for them to carve out a market niche, or they, you know, skim a lot of the cream off the crop of the patients who are able to pay, and leave to the public system, you know, those patients who are, you know, not in, they either don't have health insurance, or, you know, they're not in a position to pay in the same way. And so there really has been a, you know, a struggle among public district hospitals across the state of California. I mean, another piece that I've noticed, though, is that especially in public district hospitals, you know, we went through a pretty high-profile fight in Salinas Valley Memorial Hospital, which is a public district hospital, you know, two or three years ago, is the, you know, really the lack of responsiveness of the local elected board to the needs of the facility. And, you know, one thing that we found was the use of the public information, you know, making public Freedom of Information Act requests to really get at the root of what's going on at the hospital. And you know, you'd find kind of an old boy network operating there that certainly was not making the most efficient use of resources. And it's a bind for the public hospitals to be in terms of financing, but what we've experienced is that the management has not been very creative in trying to figure out ways to you know, both work with their employees and then, you know, more broadly work with the community to make sure that the institutions stay in place.
This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm talking to John Borsos. John is the Secretary Treasurer of the National Union of Healthcare Workers. He's talking to us today about trade unionism in the healthcare industry. Before we get back, let me remind you again that tonight the pledge drive, the KZYX pledge drive, begins. And we're hoping that you will all be generous. John, let's turn now, in the time we have left, to a little bit about the NUHW itself. You've developed a reputation for consistently opposing concessions or givebacks to hospital managements and for aggressive organizing. Could you tell us a little bit about that, and maybe very quickly the origins of NUHW and why you started a new union several years ago?
Sure. You know, you talked a little earlier, or we talked a little earlier, about the Great Recession. And interestingly enough, healthcare is one of the few industries, you know, really in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years that not only has not experienced, you know, significant cutbacks or significant, you know, crisis, but has really blossomed and profited, you know, enormously. You talked a little bit about, you know, Kaiser Permanente, you know, the largest, you know, HMO in the world, and, you know, a major provider of healthcare services here in California. Well, in the last 3 years, Kaiser has made over $6 billion in profits. You know, record profit years. Catholic Healthcare West, now called Dignity Health, has experienced its most profitable years. You know, we're in a contract negotiation with a hospital, California Pacific Medical Center. It's a Sutter. Sutter's a Sacramento-based hospital corporation. This single hospital, California Pacific, made $199 million last year. So the hospital industry is, and the healthcare industry generally is very profitable, and it has been profitable, and even with the advent of Obamacare, it's expected to remain profitable. So, you know, in contrast to what's going on in you know, the rest of society, despite this profitability, and I guess maybe because of this profitability, healthcare corporations have been seeking enormous concessions at the bargaining table, and I think it's a factor of a employer seeing what's happening in other industries and deciding, even if we don't need it financially, if other industries can get it, we're going to try to get it too. You know, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, we were founded in January of 2009, and, you know, part of the reason why we ended up having to create the union was we had been part of the Service Employees International Union, you know, for, again, part of Local 250, going back to the 1930s and before that, and had, you know, this belief that the healthcare industry was a very profitable industry, and there was no need to make concessions with employers, and that healthcare employers should be held accountable both to their workers and to communities. And that clashed with the philosophy of SEIU, and, you know, it's now departed, you know, under, you know, a cloud of controversy president, a guy named Andy Stern, who, you know, believe that because of...
We lost you there. Could you go back to Andy Stern?
Yeah, I said, you know, our clash with SEIU is the person who was leading SEIU at the time, a guy named Andy Stern, believed that the way that you address the shrinkage of the labor movement was that you accommodated yourself to corporate capitalism, and you made yourself a junior partner to whatever the corporations needed. You accommodated yourself to that corporate need, and in exchange, the corporation will allow you to represent its workers. So what the corporations got out of it was a lot of cooperation in terms of wanting to make changes, demanding concessions, driving down costs, you know, really making it harder to be a healthcare worker, you know, at the work site. And what SEIU got out of it was more people who are paying dues. And so there were a couple of very controversial things that happened in California where, you know, for example, without us knowing it, representatives of the International Union were going behind our back and trading away people's pension plans or other things that had been collectively bargained, including in one instance, the right to... They gave an employer called Tenet Healthcare the right to subcontract out work, that is to take work and give it to somebody, you know, who pays half the wages and benefits, without telling the workers whose contract it was that they had done that, in exchange for the right to organize hospital workers outside of California. So we you know, initiated that. You know, a series of you know, challenges and really accountability within SEIU, and the way that that was responded to was, you know, not only not appreciated, but, you know, a heavy, you know, attack, you know, lawsuits, a number of things, and then sometime in 2009. The union was actually taken over by the International Union. They just, you know, it's one of the ways that labor is set up, is that the International Union came in and took over this 150,000-person union, and we created the National Union of Healthcare Workers the next day to then, you know, challenge SEIU and really become a voice for healthcare workers in California and beyond.
So we've got a few minutes left, John. Let me just ask you to speculate a bit. You're in the labor movement. You're kind of on the younger side of the people who are leading unions today, but you've been doing this for, I think you said, 20 years. You speak a language of class, social class, of the working class, and maybe you could speculate a bit and about what you think about the situation of these people, this class of people in this country today, and what you'd like to see for them, and how you think the labor movement, the organized labor movement, might respond to their needs and find some way to rejuvenate itself?
Yeah, you know, I think more so, you know, probably since since the 1930s, workers are more in need of a union than they have been, you know, at any time in the, you know, probably the last 100 years. If you look at the growing, you know, levels of income inequality and just the massive amounts of money that's made by, you know, a small handful of people while everyone else is, you know, really suffering. You know, that's a byproduct of a weak labor movement. Where there was the least amount of income disparity was really in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when there was a stronger labor movement and labor represented, you know, 30 to 35% of the workforce, as opposed to the 11% that it represents today, including it's now below 7% in the private sector. You know, workers certainly deserve the right to have input about what their wages are, what their working conditions are, you know, how the place where they work is staffed. And in fact, the law of the land, the National Labor Relations Act, encourages collective bargaining, you know, here in the United States. That's not the way that it's been interpreted. Whereas, you know, today, it's you know, there's no real government agency that encourages collective bargaining. At best, they try to, you know, balance between the interest of labor and the interest of capital, when the law of the land says that collective bargaining should be encouraged. You know, the difficulty of that, I think, has also been exacerbated by really a failure on the leadership of the labor movement generally to be responsive to the needs of workers. I think this struggle that we went through with SEIU, where it was really about how many extra dues units can we get to represent, as opposed to really figuring out how to represent people at the workplace and making sure that there were improvements to wages and working conditions, and, you know, being receptive to the needs of workers that had, you know, created the cynicism on the part of workers towards unions. Fortunate thing is, you know, there are a number of really good unions who continue to do really good work, but it really requires this renewed commitment to listening to workers, understanding what their interests are, and becoming a vehicle to represent those workers in the face of, you know, the most extreme concentration of wealth, I think, that we've ever seen in this country.
And perhaps just a last word, thinking beyond the immediate election and Obamacare as it stands now, what about healthcare reform? What do you have any ideas about that, or does the NUHW?
Yeah, you know, we've always advocated, you know, for a single payer system, that, you know, healthcare should really be a human right, as opposed to, you know, the way it has evolved in this country, you know, today. I don't feel you know, optimistic about, you know, something moving beyond Obamacare at this point. I mean, look at the right-wing attack on it up to this stage, and, you know, I don't know that the Obama administration, you know, particularly the failure to even hold out for the, you know, the slimmest public option, certainly, in, you know, again, creates this kind of inspiration or aspiration for folks who know that there can be a better way of doing it. You know, I guess we're back to this place where, you know, there really is a need for a much more progressive social movement. I mean, I think what we saw even with the Occupy movements in the fall and the spring was this sense that there's clearly something wrong and there's a way to articulate it, but the real next step is taking that articulated problem that are do and making it into a viable institutionalized social movement.
All right. Well, John, thanks very much. Thanks. It's been terrific, very interesting, and I want to say good luck to you and good luck to the healthcare workers in NUHW. You've got a website quickly. Could you tell us how to check in with NUHW online?
NUHW.org.
Okay. And so we're out of time now. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. I've been talking with the labor leader John Borsos about reviving the labor movement, among other things. We'll be back again next Thursday at 9. Remember, tonight the fund drive, the pledge drive begins. Thanks again, and good morning. Okay, John, great, thanks. I know you're busy.
Hey, thanks.
Let's see. I'll make a recording of this and somehow get it to you if you're interested at some point, okay?
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
And say, give my best to everyone, and keep up the good work.
Okay, Cal, thanks a lot.
Bye.